You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good evening, everyone. Let me welcome you all to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and for the release of this new volume, which has been authored by Ben Lambert, looking at the role of the Indian Air Force during the Kargil War. The Kargil War obviously took place some time ago, but the significance of that conflict remains with us, because it proved, I think, if anyone needed reminding, that the presence of nuclear weapons in this part of the world has not made conflict obsolete. It's just pushed political conflict in new and more complex directions. And therefore, the tasks of thinking through how such conflicts will arise and how they will continue to be managed under the shadow of nuclear weapons will remain a task that policymakers and strategic thinkers will have to give consideration to for quite some time to come. The Kargil conflict is also important because it emphasized the point that how a campaign is waged is critical for the success of both politics and operations. And the way India and Pakistan conducted themselves during this conflict, I think, has important lessons on both fronts. Finally, it illustrates the fact that in conflicts of this sort, managing the international environment will be just as important as managing the domestic environment and managing the prospect of strategic bargaining with one's adversaries. These are the perennial problems of politics that were well illustrated by the Kargil conflict. And therefore, even though the conflict is now over 10 years old, studying it and understanding it remains an important task for students of South Asia. We could not have two individuals better suited to the task of reflecting on the issues that I broadly described than the gentleman sitting to my right. And on behalf of all of us, I want to extend a very special welcome to Ben Lambert and Pete Lavoie. Ben and I were colleagues at RAND 2 decades ago. And in my estimation, Ben is America's foremost civilian analyst of air power. He has close to a score book-length publications on different dimensions of air power, and has been a student of air power and the forms in which air power have been used in different parts of the world now for over 2 decades. He cut his teeth as a Soviet analyst working for the intelligence community, did some incredible work on strategic deterrence going back in the 80s. In fact, when I was a young man growing up in Bombay, I still remember reading in the USIS library an essay that was quite defining on thresholds in Soviet nuclear thought. Ben has been quite incredible in the range of his oeuvre and the density of his writing. He wrote this study as a spin-off of a monograph that he is working on the Indian Air Force for RAND. But the research that he put into the Kargil episode was so detailed, with so much more information, that we jumped at the opportunity to publish it, because much of what is in the book has not been in the public record before. And Ben has spent quite a bit of time not just trolling the public record, but actually talking to the individuals who played critical roles in this operation and distilled their understanding and their wisdom in this book. So it's a great pleasure to have Ben with us. Ben has now retired from RAND. He's a senior scholar at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis. Assessment.
Something like that.
But they do both. We also have Pete Lavoie with us today. Pete is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Department of Defense, and his responsibilities really encompass all of the Asia-Pacific region. Pete spent many years at the Naval Postgraduate School as an academic, so he has good upbringing. We then lost him from the academic community into government. He went to the intelligence community and served as Admiral Blair's deputy at a very crucial period when the office of the Director of National Intelligence was being configured and reconfigured. Pete was the principal deputy looking after analysis. And after he departed that position, came to DOD. He played a critical role, I mean, many of you may not know this, in the last several months actually negotiating with Pakistan and getting us out of the cul-de-sac that US-Pakistan relations found themselves in after the terrible events that started first with Abbottabad and then leading up to the tragedies that occurred on the border. Today, Pete has responsibility not simply for managing a range of issues relating to Pakistan and Afghanistan, but also for sustaining the Department of Defense engagement with India. And I will let him speak on that issue if he feels like it. But today, I have asked him to follow Ben Lambeth and talk to us about the strategic dimensions of the Kargil conflict, because he happens to be the editor of what, in my book, is the single best book-length treatment of the Kargil conflict. And so, besides all his policy expertise, he also brings to the table today academic excellence and a long history of understanding of this particular conflict. So without further ado, I'll yield the floor first to Ben and then invite Pete Lavoie to follow up. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ashley. I'm delighted and honored that you made it possible for Carnegie to publish this work. I need to thank Ashley also for the prodigious help he's given me over the last couple of years in understanding something that was a complete novel to me just 3 years ago, is the Indian Air Force and how it fits into India's security situation. You've been a wonderful tutor. And Pete, also, thanks for taking the time from your schedule to come and help keep me honest and provide a broader context for what I'm going to talk about. Since I'm almost done now, as Ashley mentioned, with a long in progress RAND study for the United States Air Force on India's emerging air posture, which this report is unconnected to, but a derivative of, I thought it might be helpful to open up this afternoon by first of all amplifying a bit on what is this Air Force we're talking about? What is the Indian Air Force and how do we understand it? There is a persistent view out there, I mean, even to this day, that because some 80% of India's military aircraft are of Soviet and Russian origin, it's just another big third world air force organized along the lines of other Soviet client states around the world. Nothing could be farther from the reality of this air force. To start out with, the Indian Air Force is the world's fourth largest air force, serving the world's largest democracy and its fastest growing economy after China's. It has also improved exponentially, I would say, since the early 1990s, when it had no doctrine at all to speak of, and was really really just thought of itself as it in fact was simply a tactical air arm fielded to support the Indian Army. Since that time, it has evolved into, by I think any measure, a modern air force with strategic roles and missions, including first and foremost being the principal instrument of India's nuclear deterrent and retaliatory posture. It's also very much like the United States Air Force, a full-spectrum force that operates not only highly respectable fourth-generation fighters, but also force-extending tankers, a recently acquired airborne warning and control system, an AWACS capability, long-range inter-theater airlifters, remotely piloted aircraft for conducting intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and the beginnings of a respectable military space capability. On top of that, it's manned and led by technically literate officers of uniformly high caliber, just by any standard I can think of. I have had the privilege of spending quality time with most of its senior leaders during three trips to Delhi over the past 3 years, since going back to 2008, including the last four air chiefs and a number of senior leaders on down the ranks. I've also met with, I think, the best of its successor generation, and I can say with complete confidence that, that these are airmen who can hold their own in any league in the world. The Indian Air Force operates probably the most cutting-edge fourth generation plus fighter in the world today, the Su-30 MKI. It brought eight of those jets to Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada, back in August of 2008 to take part in the quarterly Red Flag large force training exercise at the invitation of the U.S. Air Force's chief at the time, General Buzz Moseley. Its pilots and weapon systems operators were warmly welcomed by their American brethren as fellow airmen, and they performed uniformly well throughout the two-week evolution as members of the Blue Force. Their attainment of a 95% fully mission capable rate for their aircraft consistently throughout the 3 weeks put them head and shoulders above all the other participants, including the American squadrons, and then the French Rafales and South Korean F-15s that came to take part as well. And they showed consistently that they trained to the highest Western standards. In its evolving tactical repertoire, it's now well into the precision strike revolution, and its leaders are totally conversant with the best Western thinking with respect to air doctrine and force employment. It's had a long established tactics and air combat development establishment now located at Air Force Station Gwalior. It's known in the trade as TAC-D. It is the only true foreign counterpart that I'm aware of anywhere in the world to the U.S. Air Force's Weapons School at Nellis and the Navy's comparable Top Gun program at Naval Air Station Fallon. And to sum it up, I would say the Indian Air Force has more in common with the U.S. Air Force today than most other friendly air forces around the world in terms of size, composition, doctrinal orientation, and the breadth of missions that it serves. During the 10 years, during the past 10 years in particular, it has followed a truly transformational flight plan that bears many of the earmarks of the same flight plan the United States Air Force has followed since Vietnam. There was an article in an Indian trade journal a couple of years ago in which Ashley characterized both the Indian Air Force as and the U.S. Air Force as natural-born partners, and I think that really pretty much hit the nail on the head. Okay, now turning to the Cargill War of 1999, which is what we're here to talk about today, that war pretty much remains a blank to most Americans, and it was a blank to me until my first trip to India in 2008 when I first heard reference to it. I had frankly never heard of it before. It had just not come up on my radar screen. And yet, as obscure, well, part of the problem here was that it occurred at about the same time as the Kosovo campaign in the Balkans. And that pretty much crowded, I think, Cargill off the front pages. And we were all kind of consumed with that. But as I got into it, it became clear to me that this was a major, major evolution for the Indian military, and also an important chapter in the history of air warfare. It was, as Ashley suggested, it was the first and only serious clash to date between two nuclear-armed countries that ended with a clear winner and loser at the conventional level. And the clear winner was India. It also, I think, was emblematic, and Pete Lavoie's book develops this theme in some depth, the most likely sort of border war between India and Pakistan, and perhaps also between India and China, that could occur over the next decade in light of the inhibiting effect of the nuclear overhang restraining higher stakes showdowns by both sides that could escalate and get out of control irretrievably. For students of air power, which includes me among others, and perhaps I think a few others around the table here, it was the highest elevation engagement ever in the history of air warfare, in that most of the targets were situated between 16 and 18,000 feet above sea level on high mountain ridgelines. And having to operate at that high an elevation created all kinds of problems, all kinds of tactical problems with respect to weapons delivery for the Indian Air Force that I will come back to in some detail in just a bit. I think the war is important as well for a proper understanding of India's emerging air posture in that it remains the only case of recent Indian Air Force exposure to high-intensity combat that offers very clear insights into the Air Force's capabilities, its limitations, its relationship with its sister services, and its interactions with India's civilian leaders. Just to review the highlights briefly, the war lasted 74 days and resulted in more than 1,000 casualties on both sides before India finally won against the Pakistani intruders. The seeds for the campaign, the seeds for the war were planted in March and April of 1999 when units of Pakistan's Northern Light Infantry, it's a total of some 1,500 to 2,000 troops in all, I think, by the best accounting, crossed the Indian side of the line of control that separates Pakistani and India-occupied Kashmir, and moved into mountain outposts that had been vacated by Indian Army units that that just got out of Dodge because of the harsh winter weather. It was a golden opportunity, and it was taken advantage of. Just to appreciate the magnitude of the challenge, it helps to remember that the line of control bisects some of the most forbidding terrain anywhere on the planet. Most of the ridge lines up there are offshoots of K2, which is the world's second highest mountain. When the Indian Army units began to move gradually back into their vacated posts once the spring arrived and the weather improved, they discovered through some fairly vicious, unanticipated firefights the extent of what the Pakistanis had done. And it took the Army leadership more than a week to figure out really the extent of the challenge they were facing up there. I think in the first week or two after that, very much like some of you may be aware, our own experience 3 years later in Afghanistan with the U.S. Army's Operation Anaconda, the Indian Army tried to go it alone at first. We could handle this. And they were reluctant to report it up the chain of command, and they chose not to ask for air support. But finally, on the 11th of May, when it became clear that they couldn't handle it by themselves, the local Army commander made an approach to his Air Force counterpart and asked for help by his committing armed helicopters to provide air support. Now, ever since that initial Army-Air Force entreaty down at the kind of operational and tactical level, there has been a raging dispute, which I think probably continues to this day in India, about exactly what happened next. I mean, there's one pro-Army school of thought that that insists the Indian Air Force only entered the fight reluctantly after the most insistent demand by the Army leadership. Well, what actually happened, as the Indian Air Chief at the time, Air Chief Marshal Tipnis, explained in considerable detail in a long recollection about 6 years later, the local Army Air Command, the local Air Commander reported the Army request up his chain of command. He also told his Army counterpart that the terrain elevation where he needed help was too high for helicopters to operate effectively, and that any air support at that high an elevation would require the use of fixed-wing fighters. And he also said rightly that he could not approve the request on his own without getting higher headquarters approval. To make a long story short, the Air Chief then got into an extended back and forth with his Army counterparts. The Army Chief at the time was on official travel out of the country, but again affirmed that the Army, to the Army, that using armed helicopters was out of the question because the operating elevation was just beyond the capability of those aircraft to operate efficiently. And also insisted on getting the political leadership in the discussion because of concern that any introduction of air power could have an escalatory effect that might get the conflict perhaps all the way up to the nuclear level, something that was to be avoided at every cost. Finally, on the 25th of May, in the Prime Minister's presence, the three service chiefs got together. They agreed on a course of action with the express proviso from the Prime Minister that no Indian aircraft would cross the line of control while providing support to the Indian Army. And with that one binding rule of engagement firmly in place, the die was cast for a full-fledged Indian joint air and land combat operations, which began the following morning on May 26. Meantime, as far back as May 10 and 11, the Air Force had already been conducting reconnaissance flights in the area to scope out the target array. Also deployed enough aircraft to India's northernmost bases to support any likely air tasking that would be coming down from higher headquarters, and began practicing weapons delivery at Himalayan mountain ranges. Western Air Command, which was the designated air support element for the Indian Army in Kashmir, also undertook other preparatory measures, including activating its air operations center in the region, all of which efforts testify that the Air Force, from the very first, was more than ready to engage once an agreed course of action could be worked out with the Army in the joint arena and agreed to by the political leadership. Just to summarize some of the highlights of the air contribution, the first air attacks on the morning of May 26th were conducted by two ship elements of MiG-21s, MiG-23s, and MiG-27s in low-level rocket and strafing passes. On the second day, the Air Force lost two fighters in close succession. The first was a MiG-27 that flamed out coming off a target, most likely due to a rocket exhaust gas ingestion down the engine's air inlet at that rarefied, at that high elevation, where the air was much thinner than at sea level. After an unsuccessful air start attempt, the pilot ejected. He got out okay, landed fine, but he was promptly captured by the occupying Pakistanis and was held as a POW for about a week until he was then repatriated. The second aircraft loss less than an hour later was a MiG-21, which also got down low while searching for the MiG-21 pilot and took an infrared surface-to-air missile hit. Its pilot also got out okay, but he was not as lucky. He was captured and promptly brutalized and executed. His body was returned later during the campaign. And then on the third day, against the Air Force's better judgment, an Mi-17 helicopter. It was the number four aircraft in a four-ship trail formation. Took an infrared SAM hit. It was the only aircraft in the four-ship that lacked protective flare dispensers. And the crew of four, they were all killed. And at that point, the Air Force made a command decision, okay, we're not going to do this anymore, to end all helicopter operations within range of enemy fire. Also ruled that all subsequent fighter operations would remain above the enemy's infrared surface-to-air missile envelope, which dictated a hard deck of no less than 8,000 feet above the ridgelines, and again, imposing a substantial tactical constraint on weapons delivery. It made for a notable degradation of weapons accuracy. I'll come back to this in a second. The good news part of that, though, was it allowed the Air Force to get through the rest of the 74-day campaign without any aircraft losses to enemy fire. Because of their rudimentary bomb sights and the pilots' difficulty in getting visual acquisition against some of the more hard-to-see, very small troop concentrations up in the sort of snow-covered background, the antiquated MiGs didn't do very well in the close air support mission. They just didn't. The first couple of weeks did not go well. For that reason, just 4 days into the campaign, the Air Chief decided to introduce the much more modern and capable Mirage 2000, maintained by the Indian Air Force, with its computerized bombing system that allowed more accurate, unguided weapon delivery, and also the ability to drop laser-guided bombs that offered true precision accuracy. It took several weeks to configure one squadron, it was 7 squadron of Mirages, to carry the 1,000-pound Paveway 2 laser-guided bomb. However, after extensive flight trials on a very tight timeline to validate the capability, the Air Force finally dropped laser-guided bombs in combat for the first time in its history. They were used on the 24th of June against the Pakistani Army's command bunkers on Tiger Hill, a very important strategic location. And a week before that, the Air Force had also used Mirage 2000s with unguided munitions against the enemy's main logistics center and reduced that to rubble. The Air Component Commander, Air Marshal Vinod Patni, who was kind enough to give this earlier drafts of this a very careful scrub, said that that after those two game-changing events, it was really all downhill from there. From that point on, the Pakistanis would often vacate their positions at the very sound of an approaching Indian Air Force fighter. I mentioned some of the unique tactical challenges that demanding operating environment posed for the Air Force to begin with. The target elevations were so high that that the Air Force's heavy Mi-25 and Mi-35 armed attack helicopters couldn't operate at their maximum weight when fully fueled and armed. So they were never players, even right up to the end game after the enemy's infrared SAM and and aircraft artillery threat had been largely beaten down. And second, because of the Prime Minister's unwillingness, for good strategic reason, not to allow any Indian fighters to cross the line of control during their target attacks, it forced their pilots to use ingress and egress headings that oftentimes were not, certainly weren't tactically effective at all times, and in some cases weren't even safe. And third, most of the targets that presented themselves on the high ridgelines, they were just small troop positions. They were camouflaged, they were very hard to see, made for uncommonly difficult target acquisition and identification, as you might imagine, from fast-moving jets operating more than a mile above the terrain. And fourth, something that no one had really thought about much before, the elevations were such that air-delivered munitions, just they performed differently than they did at lower release altitudes, where their specifications have been carefully calibrated. The lower air temperature and density made for altered air drag indices that just hadn't been calculated before and caused weapons to land long and basically put the pilots into a kind of a try-and-see improvise mode, and it took them a number of days before they finally broke the code and adapted to that operating range. And the terrain folds were oftentimes so steep and so deep that they would mask the fragmentation pattern of bomb detonations to the point where even a near miss was ineffective if the bomb happened to land on the wrong side of the ridgeline from where the target was. So for all those reasons, the Indian Air Force rode a very steep learning curve during the first few weeks until its pilots finally got proficient at attacking hard-to-see targets at those elevations. It really, the whole experience was quite a wake-up call for the Indian Air Force, because even though that operating terrain is there, it just had not given much thought before to gaining proficiency at operating in that kind of an arena until the operational needs of the moment dictated it. So there was a lot of real-time improvising. Now, like most airmen the world over, the Indian fighter pilots, many of them were just clever, enterprising junior officers. I mean, I've often felt that one of our least known secret weapons is the smart captain and the smart major. You know, you give a problem to a captain or a major, you'll figure it out. And much the same was manifested in this case, where you know, some junior officers came up with a remarkable roster of sort of real-time fixes. One was entailed MiG-21 and MiG-27 pilots using commercial off-the-shelf GPS receivers in the cockpit for conducting night-level interdiction bombing. Another entailed picking weapon impact points designed to start avalanches or rock slides that would obstruct enemy supply lines. Still another pioneering use of the latest Indian Air Force technology was the use of electro-optical and infrared targeting pods on both the Mirages and the Jaguars for what has since come to be called non-traditional intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. By using those targeting pods for conducting high-resolution reconnaissance of the battle space. To end the campaign itself, the Indian Army finally recaptured Tiger Hill on July 4th, and 3 weeks later had reclaimed most of the positions that had been previously vacated. Now, looking back with 2020 hindsight at who did what from a pure weight of effort perspective, I mean, clearly the Indian Army carried the bulk of the effort when it came to providing direct fire support. I mean, I think something like 250,000 rounds of artillery were expended throughout the campaign. That is probably the most massive and intense and sustained artillery laydown ever seen anywhere in the world since World War II. In contrast to this, and I'm quoting, this profligacy in the use of artillery in a carpet bombing mode, as Air Marshal Patney wrote to me in a comment on my draft, the Air Force only dropped around 500 bombs in all. Those that were employed in a close quarters, close air support role were not very effective, but the ones used in interdiction against larger fixed targets were quite effective, and were considered were significant players. Looking back at it, it would be hard, I think, almost impossible to say which service was more pivotal in shaping the course and outcome, because both the Army and the Air Force were key players. So, to that extent, asking which service was more important, it's kind of like asking which blade in a pair of scissors is more important than cutting the paper. I mean, they were both critical to producing the outcome. But it was the Indian Air Force's first combat test since 1971, and to that extent, it remains a benchmark in air warfare history and in Indian military combat experience. After kinetic air operations ended on the 12th of July, the Air Force had flown a total of 1,700 fighter sorties in the strike, fighter escort, and reconnaissance roles. And with regard to mobility, resupply to the Indian Army, its helicopters flew nearly 2,500 sorties, and its transport aircraft flew more than 3,400 sorties. So, I mean, a fairly substantial level of effort by any measure. One key effect achieved by the combat air patrols that the Indian Air Force mounted on a sustained basis was preventing Pakistani helicopters from evacuating their wounded. And more important, the Air Force's ability to work within the constraint dictated by the Prime Minister against crossing the line of support may have been the main factor that kept the Pakistani Air Force out of the fray and maintaining escalation control throughout the campaign. Looking back at it again from an air power perspective, the Air Force's performance, it showed that innovation and adaptability are kind of generic hallmarks of well-cultivated airmanship worldwide. It showed the professionalism in such activities as presentation of forces, campaign planning, meeting the needs of a joint force commander. These are by no means a monopoly of the best Western air arms. From a joint arena perspective, the Army's, I'll just say it point blank, the Army's parochialism and organizational dysfunction during the first week or two that delayed the Air Force's entry into the campaign planning process at first showed an absence of open inter-service communication and interdependence that is by no means an affliction of the United States and our closest allies. And finally, from a regional security perspective, I think the war showed, and Pete can amplify on this, that the mere existence of a nuclear deterrence relationship between India and Pakistan, and for that matter, between India and China, has not ruled out the continued possibility of future conventional wars of major consequence. In this particular case, the regional imbalance, I mean, a clear asymmetry in favor of India with nearly 150 fourth-generation MiG-29, Su-30, and Mirage 2000 fighters as contrasted to only 26 frontline Pakistani F-16As at the time, I think was probably enough to keep the Pakistani Air Force out of the fight. It'd be interesting to hear the perspective from both of the attachés on that particular point. And one lesson that the Indian government almost surely learned from that experience was it pays to maintain the greatest possible degree of local superiority in the air balance along India's most conflicted border regions with both Pakistan and China. And not surprisingly, particularly in the past couple of years, the Indian Air Force has substantially strengthened its presence of forward-deployed Su-30 MKIs at its northernmost bases closest to the Chinese border. That's all I've got to say by way of kind of summarizing in a nutshell what's here. You and Pete may want to add some thoughts that I forgot to include. Feel free to argue with me, but let's hear Pete's perspective, and then we'll open it up for general discussion.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot. This is a real, this monograph is a real pleasure to read, and I guess it's now out for release, so I hope everybody does read it. There are a lot of fascinating exchanges, perspectives, interviews, really tremendous research that make it a really compelling read. And you didn't share all of them, so there's still a lot of juicy stuff in there. And I think it's an extremely important product. When I was doing research on Cargill, which really spanned, I don't know, about 6 years or so, a lot of effort to try to understand what was going on. And basically, with each year of research, I was peeling one more layer of the onion. And I think people were crying in certain places as I got a little deeper in that. And in fact, as I was getting ready to publish the book, the Pakistan ambassador here at the time, Ambassador Mahmood Durrani, I told him, I said, Ambassador, much long work has gone into this, but the Cargill book's about to come out. And he says, I'm very, very concerned, I'm very worried about this. And I said, why are you worried? We've really done all this research, all this due diligence. We're actually going to bring the truth out. He says, that's why I'm worried. But for those of you that are familiar with that episode in South Asia's history. There's still a lot of material that hasn't come out, a lot of layers of the onion that still remain to be unpeeled, and I think this book does a really good job of taking another section out, and it's really the section of the circumstances surrounding India's application of air power, and also the reasons why India chose not to go more aggressively in the application of air power, even though it would have tactical advantages, probably operational advantages. But they didn't, and that really gets to what I'd like to talk about, and it's kind of the point where Ben left off, and that's the strategic set of circumstances in South Asia then and today. In fact, if you go through, I think, the recent history of South Asia, the history between India and Pakistan, you can probably identify three recent historical phases. One is the phase that really occurred, maybe started before, but certainly at the time of the Kargil conflict in the spring and summer of 1999, but extended through the really audacious attack on the Indian Parliament on December 13th, 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks here. And in each of these cases, both sides made preparations for war. They fought a limited war in 1999, and they mobilized for a major full-out war in 2001 and then 2002. And it was a real potential for each one to escalate to full general war. And in fact, and I don't think it's reflected in this book, but my understanding is that the Indian Army was losing confidence in its ability to root out the the Pakistani soldiers that had taken these forward positions, and were contemplating opening up another front, which would have expanded the war considerably. But I think it was the combination of the application of air power and the ground activities, those two shears of a scissor, and ultimately a decision taken by the Pakistanis not to expand this, although there was considerable debate at the time to expand this, the situation de-escalated. You probably know that you're much more familiar with the story of what happened after the attack on the Indian Parliament, the full mobilization, and it took many, many, many months before that situation de-escalated. And it really, I think, on at least two occasions, came very close to erupting into war. So that was one phase. That was a pretty dangerous phase when you look back at it. That led to an ensuing phase where the Pakistanis were pretty happy. I think the Pakistan military saw that they basically had deterred war, certainly in the second episode. And so they were pretty content with the defense strategy that they had. In contrast, the Indians were very unpleased, and the Indian military in particular was unpleased. And I think they embarked on a very deliberate strategy to develop capabilities and plans for the use of military force, conventional military force, quickly and decisively, and to basically puncture Pakistan's defense deterrent strategy. And I think they wanted to... their objectives was to operate quickly to get ahead of Pakistan's ability to mobilize and create a credible threat of blunting the attack. But they also probably wanted to get ahead of decision-making in India, where, after the heat of the moment, maybe cooler heads would prevail and there are more reasons not to press the attack, and also to get into ahead of the decision-making loop in the United States and other powers that might act to constrain and kind of manage the crisis. Over a period of basically over a decade, the Indian military has developed more impressive options for these conventional strikes, the application of air power and ground power, and possibly, although it's hard to imagine, the joint application of air and ground power by India, such that I won't evaluate whether it's a credible threat or not, but I think the important point is the Pakistan military believes that India has developed capabilities that might convince the political leadership in India to launch these. And so the perception in Pakistan today, now we get into the third phase, is that the Indians have in fact created a gap in this defense deterrence continuum by Pakistan. So the third phase, which has started a few years ago but is very much intensifying today, is that Pakistan is not only relooking at its conventional military doctrine and capability, although it's under incredible stress because of the huge effort in western Pakistan, a very intense military campaign that shows no sign of easing going after the insurgents in western Pakistan. Partly because of that, partly because of India's conventional advantages, partly because of Pakistan's economic and resource constraints, it's now dedicating a major effort to expand its nuclear program. And what that means is developing fissile material as fast as possible, designing new warheads, configuring, looking at a whole range of delivery systems for nuclear use, from a series, a very large series of strategic nuclear delivery systems with expanded range, greater accuracy, and enhanced payload, as well as now a new range of tactical nuclear weapons for battlefield use, for use possibly even on Pakistani territory, and possibly for use very, very early in a conflict with India. So it creates a very different situation where in the past, and I think you got a sense from Ben, how this unfolded over time. There was innovation, there was a chance to kind of consider what would be the next step, both at the military level, the Air Force and the Army, the ground forces, but also at political and bureaucratic levels and international diplomacy. So we now have a new situation that's emerging. We're on the precipice of a new situation where we might not have that time anymore. There might be inherent pressures for Pakistan to use nuclear weapons early in a crisis, and there might be commensurate pressures by Indian armed forces to strike those Pakistani tactical forces, or possibly other forces, even earlier in a crisis so that they wouldn't be used against India. So we're in a very, very tense situation. Now, this is all taking place in the backdrop of a couple of, I think, very important elements that are very troubling to us in policymaking, and I'm sure to you as well. One is that in Pakistan, you continue to have the growth, the expansion of a wide variety of militant groups that are operating in and around Pakistan. These groups are very interested in thwarting any effort for India and Pakistan to normalize relations. We've seen that manifest in the past. I think we should expect to see it happen in the future. And so we therefore are confronted with a kind of a logical series of very troubling, destabilizing events that could culminate in a very serious nuclear crisis. One is the possibility, the ever-present possibility, of spectacular attacks by militant groups against India, and of course Pakistan, but most notably in this case against India, leading to high pressure for India to undertake a conventional military response of some sort, leading, as I said, to Pakistan's high pressure to use nuclear weapons, and possibly leading to escalation to nuclear use by both sides. By the way, my part of the talk is a lot more depressing than Ben's. He was the kind of uplifting air power.
Yeah, but the good news part of that is you're talking about hypotheticals, by and large.
I hope so. But I think there's getting to the heart of Ben's really superb research, I think a key theme that you draw out of there is the utter lack of coordination between the Indian Air Force and the Indian Army. And what I think is a kind of a startling observation of really some loose command and control exercise by the Indian civilian leadership, despite the Indian civilian leadership's very intense effort historically to exercise very stringent command and control. But when you read and hear about the Indian Air Chief authorizing his forces to undertake hot pursuit across that line of control, which he thought was in the spirit of what the Indian leadership authorized the Indian Army to do across the ground line of control, it's potentially very troubling. The other thing that I think really deserves more rigorous research, and it follows up from Ben's great research and what I was talking about, is in this emerging dynamic with the development and possible deployment of Pakistani nuclear tactical nuclear weapons, if you don't have unified military efforts, really on either side of the border, but in this case, India, I mean, do you have a possibility where the Indian Air Force might actually start a nuclear war by its actions designed to do the right thing, but really out of sync with what the Indian ground forces might be doing, and certainly out of sync with the Indian political leadership? So it's something that I'm not suggesting is a likely scenario, but I think it's just something that you know, the great minds assembled here should look into, and it's something that we'd certainly appreciate insights from that research. Let me just wrap up by talking about I forgot, there's another problem too. I was going to get to the hopeful stuff, but there's one more problem. So it's not only the sort of the terrorism, the insurgents, the growing infrastructure of militancy in Pakistan and increasingly in Afghanistan that might threaten India. But you also have a new dynamic as we look to the end of December 2014, where there's a fundamental change in the U.S. mission and the ISAF mission in Afghanistan. And everybody in the world now is really starting to fixate on that end date of December 2014, January 2015. And I think what we're seeing is when we look back, historians will look back at this last decade that will culminate at that point of a decade plus, really would be a historical aberration in the history of South Asia, where you have a very heavy U.S. and NATO military presence in the middle of South Asia, which has basically put the India-Pakistan military competition on the back burner. There's really no space today for India and Pakistan to fight a war. Now, there's a risk, but I don't really think there's much space. But as U.S. forces draw down, I think Indians and Pakistanis are looking to a resumption of the dynamic that we saw in those earlier phases that I was talking about, phase that led to Kargil and December 13th, 2001. A possible driver or sort of or multiplier of this dynamic could be a growing competition between India and Pakistan for influence in Afghanistan, along with other countries, Iran and plenty of other countries. I don't think that's predestined, and in fact, it's a goal of U.S. policy to work very closely with India, more closely than ever before, and to work closely with Pakistan, more closely than ever before, trying to harmonize all of the regional approaches and international approaches to Afghanistan. And I think that's actually making considerable progress. I don't think you read about this a lot, and that's partly by design, but I think it's making some real progress here. So I think, you know, Afghanistan is kind of a wild card in this dynamic between India and Pakistan, but the military logic is continuing to move apace between India and Pakistan on that border. Okay, I told you there would be some good news, and there's a little bit of good news here, too. There are a number of developments that are occurring in the region that I think will moderate what might be a sort of military driver to crisis and crisis escalation in the future. And that's that both sides recognize that there's a lot more to be gained by normalization of relations between India and Pakistan. And there have been some very positive steps achieved recently, some moving to normalization by visa reforms between India and Pakistan, economic liberalization between the two. You now have a situation where at least I think a couple of banks on each side are authorized to take up shop on the other side, so you can actually begin to have commerce across the border, which you couldn't really have before in any, you know, modern sense. You also have in Pakistan a growing assertiveness by civilian leadership, which wants to, I believe, get out of this cycle of military crisis and near conflict and actual war in the past. And I think that's very positive. But you do have political volatility in Pakistan, which is kind of a truism, and you have political change that will be occurring in India too. So there are a lot of dynamics that could end up being very, very positive, and of course that's what we're trying to support, but it could go the other way too. The United States really doesn't have a real direct role in what's transpiring between India and Pakistan, and that's probably one reason why it's actually becoming a lot more successful, because it really is a reflection of the interests of each country, not moderated or manipulated by the United States. And I think that's a very positive development. Let me just leave, and I know there are a lot of probably people who want to talk to Ben and a lot of questions about his really excellent research, but I just say, you know, coming out of this, I think it's really only by understanding kind of three sets of dynamics can we really come up with some ideas to prevent another Cargill or an escalation of a Cargill in the future. I mean, we really have to look back and understand the dynamics that drive crises in this part of the world. What are the political and other causes of crises? And today we need to have a sober assessment of what are those factors, and I tried to list a few. We also need to understand the factors affecting national decision-making, both at the political level and the bureaucracy, and we also need to look together with that what drives crisis behavior. India and Pakistan, the crisis behavior of these countries defies all the theories in the literature of international relations. You know, you've got the optimists and pessimists. I think they still call them that, don't they? But it just cuts right down the middle of that, and it kind of, you know, nullifies all of the hypotheses of each side. It's something very, very unique, and you have to understand it in those terms, I think. And finally, and I think an area that is incredibly important and often neglected, you need to understand the intentions, plans, and capabilities of the Indian and Pakistani armed services, because it's their activities, it's their intentions, plans, and capabilities that create independent variables in how crises will escalate into warfare and how limited warfare could escalate into major war, possibly nuclear war. They have an independent logic. And I think one of the lasting contributions of Ben's research here is that this is the single best case where you're unearthing the logic of one of those services, the Indian Air Force. And I think that's this has continuing value in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. I think that worked out much better than we had even planned, because the complementarity of the two presentations really gave you a sense of everything from the tactical to the grand strategic. We're going to open the floor, so all interventions are welcome. Just raise your hand and identify yourself, and then you can feel free to direct your questions or comments to any one of the two presenters. Yes, ma'am.
Seema Siru. I was just wondering, if the Indian Air Force had crossed the line of control, what would have been the U.S. reaction? I've often sort of wondered about it, because I've heard U.S. generals say that they couldn't believe that India didn't retaliate, you know, in a manner more aggressive.
He's the policy guy. I'll give you kind of Ben's. I'm just a political scientist in North Carolina.
Don't buy that.
You're going to fool us.
The first thing is, I'm not sure if it would have been clear to anybody whether the line of control had been crossed or not. I mean, it's not painted on the ground, and that is incredibly rugged terrain. There was no external monitoring of exactly where each aircraft was at any given nanosecond in time. So, and as a matter of fact, it's possible that the line of control was violated from time to time. And I've heard it speculated that just by happenstance, oops, didn't mean to do there, but lo and behold, I better get back inside where I belong, that in fact did happen. My kind of fingertip deal is that had particular Indian pilots for particular tactical reasons crossed the line of control once or twice, you know, just to avoid an unsafe situation where they're making themselves predictable, and it was detected somehow, it might have ended right there. I think it becomes a problem for U.S. policy and for escalation management only when the consequences of crossing the line of control get to a point where now you've got a qualitatively different operational problem. You now have the Pakistani Air Force saying, okay, well, if you did it, we can do it too. And next thing you know, you have air-to-air combat and either Indian or Pakistani jets getting shot down, and now the fat's in the fire. I mean, if it had gotten to that point, then I can see that the United States government would, at the very least, have raised an eyebrow and said, uh-oh, let's better watch this more closely. But I don't believe that just a discrete violation here or there of the line of control would have made any difference. It's because it would have been very hard to detect. I don't know. Do you have any thought on that?
I think the line was violated. I mean, aircraft do fly over. They were flying over the line. I think they had rules of engagement that told them not to. But
and it was a good ROE. I mean, it was good.
It was strong. It was clear. But as you indicated, for safety reasons and other, it's just very hard to operate right along the edge with the kind of speeds and given the terrain, the very, very intense mountainous terrain that's there. And again, in the book, that comes alive when you read Ben's book, that you know, the sense you get. And everybody I talked to in Cargill, I mean, that was, everyone was awestruck, not as much by the war, but by the terrain. And I think it affected both. It was debilitating to all the people as much as anything that the enemy was doing. But I think ultimately, you know, the story of Cargill, it's kind of a study in restraint. Not restraint at the tactical level. I think, you know, the accounts of the fighting on the mountains, on Tiger Hill, but all the other peaks, it's as horrendous as military fighting anywhere in the world, maybe more so because of these conditions. Incredible acts of valor, courageousness, but also incredible suffering. So that was as intense as it could possibly be. And the Indian Air Force was, when it was doing what it was doing, it was playing for keeps. And it was also very intense. But each side had limits placed on how they would operate. Pakistan deliberately chose not to reinforce its positions. And was that a tactical blunder? Was it a strategic calculation? You know, people can judge, but they really left their positions exposed. India took advantage of that, but at the cost of the loss of hundreds of lives. And if India had attacked rear positions, they probably could have done that in a way that would have risked many, many fewer lives trying to climb up these incredibly high mountain peaks, the highest peaks in the world. But
sometimes they were actually vertical rock faces where the troops are climbing up ropes and driving rain.
Right, but the risk then would have been escalation of the risk of escalation to a broader war, opening up other fronts and vertical escalation. But they weren't prepared to do that.
Now you had one comment that prompted me to think, if I had this to do over again, I might have done one thing a little bit differently. Your reference to the Air Chief Marshal, the Air Chief's comment in his recollection 6 years later
that
oh, by the way, no, I wouldn't. I would have moved it into the main text. The Air Chief, the Air Chief's comment in passing in his recollection that, you know, he didn't bother to ask political permission, but he just told the guys, you know, if you get engaged, you're cleared hot to, you know, to go in hot pursuit. That is a fundamental change in the chemistry of the conflict, and he did it on his own recognizance. And I'm thinking now, if I had it, I buried that in a footnote, just an oh, by the way, because it came into the drafting this thing very late in the game. But I might, with hindsight now, move it into the text and talk about some of the downside consequences had, for any reason, any Indian Air Force pilots actually acted on that because of some tactical exigency of the moment.
It reminds you of an issue that became quite clear during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where Even though political authorities seeking to maintain a set of restraints for strategic objectives, the very logic of military operations exerts itself and often pushes the edge. And because of the military operations involved here, where, you know, the chiefs have a responsibility to their services, to their men, they tend to think of it more in operational terms. and the divorce between the necessities of operational success and political success oftentimes become acute. And I think this is one more example of that. I wanted to say something to the point about restraint that Peter made. You have to understand restraint also in the context of the objectives of both sides. For Pakistan, the objectives were really plausible deniability. And if there was an effort to reinforce, then the deniability that Pakistan was trying to kind of protect throughout the crisis would have been compromised. And restraint in the Indian end was really driven by their conviction that they needed to keep the international community, in a sense, in their corner. And it was very important to be seen as a responsible response to victimization, to geopolitical victimization. So I think that context of the context imposed by the objectives of both sides, I think, is important.
Let me ask you a what if there. I mean, on plausible deniability and what they expected would be the outcome in the end game. I also last year finished a major Iran study on Israel's 2006 war in Lebanon against Hezbollah, and one of the interesting little nuggets I came up with in my research, having to do with the grossly disproportionate Israeli response to really what was a minor Hezbollah border provocation. It is still widely thought that Israel did not do well in that campaign, and for some reasons you can say that they in fact could have done better. But they bruised Hezbollah badly. I mean, they killed 700 of their combatants, their most highly trained soldiers. They demolished the Hezbollah's military infrastructure. I mean, you go on and on and on, to the point where some weeks after the campaign ended, Nasrallah, the commander of Hezbollah, was asked, you know, if you knew with 2020 hindsight, you know, how the Israeli response would be, would you have done it? And he said, you ask if I would have done it, but not only no, but hell no, I would not have. Now, by the same token, you know, I've heard it argued that the Pakistani planners who orchestrated the incursion must not have had the slightest clue that the response they got was the response that was going to be forthcoming. And you can ask the same what-if question in that context. Had Musharraf known, assuming he was the chief planner, had he known beforehand that this would be the opportunity cost of making that move, would he have done it? I think it's a fair guess that he might have said, yeah, it's not worth it.
Well, let's get this conversation open, because in Peter's book, I think this issue is actually treated at quite some length. And Peter's book is quite remarkable because it does a really good job of unpacking the Pakistani calculus, which has not come out with the clarity that you get on the Indian side, simply because the Indian output in terms of analysis and stuff was just orders of magnitude more than what came out of the Pakistani side. But Peter can speak to this if we want to as we go down the line.
You have partly answered, actually, the question I wanted to ask. I mean, there was a theoretical risk of escalation. But, I mean, do we have any indication that the Pakistani side, they were ready to retaliate in any meaningful way at the Indian Air Force violated too blatantly the line of control? I mean, on top of the need for plausible deniability, I mean, the overall international context was, for the first time, perhaps in a long time, in favor of India, including on the U.S. side, and so on. I mean, there was a whole set of condition which made the escalation quite difficult for Pakistan. But I mean, were there any indication that we're ready to do it militarily and willing to do so?
I'll take a shot at that. I think what Ashley said earlier is very important. I mean, consider the broader objectives and orientations of each country toward this conflict at different phases of time. And I think that's the phasing is important. I'm pretty confident there were very significant debates in Pakistan about which examined the possibility of escalating the conflict horizontally, opening up other fronts. India did some things in this conflict, and it's really on the ground war side, by concentrating its Bofor guns. It became, I think, from the Pakistani military view, India became very unbalanced, and it created vulnerabilities that Pakistan considered exploiting at that time. So if, well, there, you know, these things are always, there are meetings and discussions that are debated. If in the context of one of those debates where somebody was making an impassioned presentation to actually up the ante on India, and there was a transgression at that time by the Indian Air Force that was a little bit more in your face to Pakistan, that might have tilted the scales. But I think it's also important to know that this was an army deal for Pakistan. The Air Force was not even notified about this whole plan, even when it was going on. Pakistani Air Force was in the dark for a long time, as was the Pakistan Navy, but they, you know, didn't have a lot to do with this. And though the other thing is, you said the Army and the Air Force. If you talk to the Indian Navy, they said they won Kargil by mobilizing and showing the Pakistanis that they really meant business. So it's kind of overdetermined, I think, on that side.
There was, though, an Indian Navy response that was non-trivial in terms of...
Go ahead.
Well, it was called Operation Talwar, which means sword, I understand, and... the Indian Navy, I don't recall the details off the top of my head, but they basically deployed the fleet and presented a de facto blockade of Pakistan that could have had dire consequences had Fort Pakistan had it been enforced. So it's not a well known part of the Pakistan of the Kargil story, but it was there and it was not insignificant. However, the Indian Navy did not win Kargil.
Please,
Scott. Yes, sir. Thanks, first of all, for a fantastic presentation. I really enjoyed the monograph, and I actually enjoyed reading a lot of your work.
Thank you.
And one of the most interesting aspects, I thought, was your detailing of escalation management and how fortunate it was that the Indian Air Force's conventional superiority deterred the Pakistani Air Force.
I think it did. Mm-hmm. You can't say this with scientific certitude, but I mean, the imbalance was so asymmetric that, to my mind, it almost had to have been
the Pakistani officer saying that it was a very effective vertical asymmetric escalation.
That was Air Commodore Tufail. He was, I think, the director of operations of the Pakistani Air Force.
So in your opinion, if a similar situation occurred today, and I realize that situations are never similar, but if one did occur, do you think the Pakistani Air Force would be similarly deterred?
I don't think it would be the Pakistani Air Force's call to engage. The real question is, would the Pakistani government be similarly deterred? And I don't know. I don't know how you answer that question. I would want to probably, first of all, just look at the order of battle on both sides today and see what the actual operational chemistry would be. I suspect that certainly the lineup of forces on both sides is different than it was in 1999. Whether it continues to be as robust on India's behalf as it was then, so I need to look at it before really trying to answer the question. But yeah, I can imagine circumstances in which both sides saw higher stakes at risk, and to the extent that that was the case, that the prospects of escalation control would be less in those circumstances than it was then, when after all the planners of the incursion hadn't expected it to go beyond anything other than just okay, basically exercising eminent domain. We're there, you know, possession is nine-tenths of the law, and thought that the conflict would end at that point. Well, it didn't, to their profound surprise. And I suspect that after, they were just improvising after the first 10 days. How would it play out? That's why political science is a contradiction in terms.
Let me take a stab at that, and despite the contradiction in terms. I think Kargil really was launched, in a sense, to from the point of view of the planners, to right the injustice or to set the, to balance, rebalance the equation in light of India's seizing Siachen in 1984. So there was still some, built up emotion over that, and this seemed like a pretty good opportunity. It also was driven by civil-military dynamics. If right before this, for the first time in Pakistan's history, an army chief was asked to resign, and he actually did, Jahangir Karamat. And I think my sense is that when General Musharraf was selected to be the army chief of staff and came in, the first thing he said to his corps commanders is that I'm no JK. In other words, this is gonna there's a new sheriff in town. We're gonna operate a little differently. And there was a strong incentive to do something to kind of create, to beef up the elan and the stature of the Pakistan army, military, and also to sort of tilt the scales and the what had become a disfavorable civil-military balance, viewing Nawaz Sharif as someone who is trying to amass total power in Pakistan. So that was a dynamic. And I think you, in the book that I edited, we get into this. And I think you also have to understand it from the point of view of the ambitions of the individuals that were involved in the planning of Cargill. And there were four of them, and not more than four of them. Clearly, none of these reasons was sufficient to escalate the war, and the Pakistan did the right thing. And the Pakistan Air Force did the right thing by not escalating, I think. I can't imagine a future conflict between India and Pakistan erupting over a situation in the Himalayas. This is done. A situation in the line of control, that's done. It's so heavily, both sides are so much more vigilant today because of these episodes.
When you think of it, I mean, the stakes were minuscule.
Right, and today the stakes are much higher. So would Pakistan use air power? I think it really depends on the circumstance. And I think any conflict in the future, particularly given the presence and growth of nuclear weapons, would really be presented by, you know, to the decision makers on both sides as an existential conflict. So you have a situation where, again, it's a study in contrast. The pressures for restraint are very, very strong and will grow only stronger. But the pressure for quick decisive action, if that can blunt what might come from the other side, is growing very high too. But, you know, welcome to our Cold War. This was the history of the dynamic between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So don't get rid of those books or keep them on your Kindle or whatever you're doing there.
Wolf Gross, history has a bad habit of repeating itself. And I wondered if in your research, has anybody mentioned that Cargill 1999 was not a first occurrence, that 34 years previously, just before the 65 war, the Pakistanis did exactly the same thing. And I wondered if any of this came up, although the reaction to it at that time was delayed reaction. It took 2 months for the real war to start.
It did not come up on my radar display. I wondered to what extent it might have animated the strategic calculus of the Indian civilian leadership. I don't know, Pete. Do you have a thought on that?
It's true, very true. Actually, it played Cargill, that part of that sector of the Himalayas played a pretty active role in the 47-48 war as well, too. So, and this isn't, I mean, the interesting thing about this terrain, it's where Pakistan has tactical advantage.
Right.
And it presents a vulnerability of the connection between India and basically defending against China. It's an acute vulnerability. And the biggest criticism, I think, in Pakistan of launching the Cargill operation was that you had an area of advantage that could be exercised in the O plan when you actually fight the big war. That's the Cargill plan was a piece of the overall big war plan, and these guys got too greedy and ambitious and they used it right then and there rather than waiting for a rainier day when the stakes were more serious. I think that's the biggest criticism, and the people around these planners of Cargill think that they wasted an opportunity that could have presented itself when you really faced a more existential threat. But they, again, were too greedy.
You know, there's another interesting question that arises. It's kind of late in the day to engage it, but it's the question of what lessons were learned on both sides. There's a chapter, there are actually two chapters in Pete's book dealing with both the Indian and the Pakistani perspectives here. I don't like the term lessons learned because they usually aren't. In this case, I mean, it seems to me that this experience was ripe with potential lessons for both sides. You know, the lesson, I would think, and again, Ashley and Pete can both give me a sanity check on this. I think one clear lesson, and I touched on it in my opening remarks, was that a lesson for India is that it pays to have a palpable conventional asymmetry in these hot border areas. is a hedge against future contingencies like Cargill. And for Pakistan, it seems to me an instructive lesson would be you better consider the downside consequences of what you do very carefully before you take a frivolous effort to rip off a couple of square miles of terrain. Like Nasrallah, are they now more deterred than they were in 1999 against doing something similar in the future? My guess would be yes, because common sense dictates it. Cross your fingers, and you're right. Ashley, where did I have anything wrong? Did I have anything wrong with this?
No. I thought it was an excellent, excellent monograph. In part because unpacking the detail, which you know exists in multiple sources and bits and pieces, and tying it into a coherent narrative is actually a service to certainly lazy researchers like me who want it in canned form. And I think it raises questions, obviously, that are not answered in the monograph, because that's not the point of the monograph. But it raises the kinds of strategic level issues that I think will remain with us. I mean, the questions about command and control, the questions about civil-military relations, the questions about jointness. I mean, these are big issues that are, you know, going to be perennial.
And do you have any idea or any reason to believe that the Indian Defense Establishment conducted its own, perhaps classified, lessons learned effort from this experience?
Oh, I have no doubt that they did.
They did?
Absolutely. I just want to, but since we're coming to the end. Oh, you.
I have a question.
Okay.
Go ahead. I'm Yashwant Raj from Hindustan Times. I covered the Kargil War, and so I was just wondering. I hadn't heard of this that the Indian pilots were using GPS, commercially available GPS systems to find the targets. So would you like to talk about this a little, because this to me has been completely new, right? So
I reached the limit of my ability to do that pretty quickly because I'm not deeply conversant with the technical application.
Not only GPS, but such other innovations, other new...
lightning. GPS and lightning.
You know, I spoke of some of the tactical innovations, you know, causing avalanches.
Yeah, that's the other one, yeah.
The, you know, using handheld video tape recorders to map targets.
Handheld.
Again, another form of non-traditional ISR. The decision to put the Mirage 2000 in to take advantage of the computerized bombing system that the aircraft has for more precise application of unguided munitions. The problem with the MiG-21, MiG-23, MiG-27 is that they all basically have iron sights. Basically, it's a grease pencil on the windscreen, and you know you roll in, you put the pipper on the target, and you pickle and pull off, and you get a 500 foot miss, that's probably still a qualifying bomb in training. Whereas with the Mirage 2000, once that was introduced, now you've got what's called a continuously computed release point, continuously computed impact point capability, where the pilot basically superimposes a death dot. He puts a cursor on the target, pushes a consent button on the control stick, and the computer does its thing. And when all the parameters converge, the bomb comes off the aircraft, and you can predict with reasonable certainty it's going to go where that cursor was. So that was an innovation. They'd never done that before, I mean, even in the training environment. So I would probably have to do an inventory to come up with a longer laundry list for you. You could probably do it.
I'd look forward to that.
I could spend 6 or 7 hours at an Indian fighter base at the officers' club with the guys who were there, and I would come back with reams of interesting insights.
In
Hindi, is it called Jugad?
Jugad. That's exactly it.
It was Air Marshal Jimmy Bhatia who taught me that word. And it's really a hallmark of airmen worldwide. You know, yeah. Smart fighter pilots will figure it out. I think the loose translation is frugal engineering.
Yep.
Is making the best you can with what you've got. That was a powerful word. I liked that. It taught me a lot.
Absolutely.
Is that kind of what you were looking for, though?
More of that, yes.
Okay. I mean, there's quite a bit of that in the monograph.
Okay.
As you read the monograph, you'll see at several points, descriptions of what was done.
Okay.
But I would make the point, though, that this is, again, another example
of how under conditions of war, it just forces you to kind of plumb the depths of innovation because your systems don't work as expected. And the difference between an adaptable force that succeeds and a non-adaptable force is exactly this, the ability of individuals in those circumstances to improvise. And there's a history on both sides, actually, going back over three wars, where soldiers, airmen, naval officers have basically improvised solutions that enabled them to do things that was absolutely not anticipated before the war comes. And again, I don't think India and Pakistan are unique in that either. If you look at the way the US military, for example, improvised both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, at every step, junior officers, NCOs, using technologies that, sometimes they ordered themselves. I mean, they actually, went to Amazon or went to whatever, bought certain things because they thought that was, would provide some tactical utility rather than waiting for the military.
I think in Afghanistan, we're ready for another innovation. We're due for one. But I would just say that Ben, I think your next, in what you guys were saying, I think your next project should be looking at the Pakistan Air Force. Because today, what the Pakistan Air Force is doing in operations against insurgents in western Pakistan is truly remarkable. And it's using good old F-16s, and particularly they've got really advanced the Block 52 F-16s.
Which they did not have at the time.
They did, at that time, they didn't. But what they are doing with precision strike is really a remarkable thing. And so maybe in another year, we can come back here and hear you talk about that.
I wonder if it would be as researchable as this was. Just by virtue of
the right officers club.
I would just by way of conclusion, I'd say that this jugaad, this frugal engineering, this figuring it out by smart young operators. I mean, this is not India specific, it's part of the fighter pilot culture. You saw it in Vietnam. Any of you ever hear of something called Operation Bolo? In 1967, Colonel Robin Olds was the 8th Fighter Wing Commander. And with all of the constraints imposed from the top down by McNamara, you couldn't attack the MiG bases, and the North Vietnamese MiGs were coming up basically with impunity. And a couple of smart captains at the bar one night said, let's try something different. So they planned a major strike package involving about 8 warships of F-4C air-to-air fighters, configured for air-to-air combat, but using the radio call signs and carrying the electronic countermeasures pods of the F-105 strike bomber to simulate a flight of 105s going into downtown Hanoi, which, sure enough, flushed the MiGs, and I think 7 of them got shot down within about 5 minutes, and that was about half of the North Vietnamese MiG-21 force at the time. Important to remember, though, that a tactic tried once is no longer a tactic, it's a procedure. So you have to be doing it all the time.
Well, on that note, I think this is an invitation to retire to the bar ourselves. But I want to thank all of you for coming, and in a special way, I want to thank both Ben and Peter for taking the time to do this, and particularly Peter, because I know the press of obligations that he has in his current employment. But all the best to you both in whatever you're up to next.
Thank you.
Thank you all.